Though only 12, Leet went out on Razzia raids with his Freeman brothers and had already killed Harkonnens. For more than a year, he and his friends, led by the brash Stilgar, had struck targets that others refused to consider. Only a week before, Leet's companions had blown up a dozen patrol thopters at a supply post. Unfortunately, the Harkonnen troops had taken their revenge against poor villagers, seeing no difference between settled folk and the will-of-the-sand freemen. He hadn't told his father about his guerrilla activities, since the elder kinds wouldn't understand the necessity. Premeditated violence, for whatever reason, was a foreign concept to the planetologist. But Leet would do what needed to be done. Now the ground car approached a village tucked into the rocky foothills. It was called Bilar Camp on their terrain maps. Pardet continued to talk about Melange and its peculiar properties. They found spice too soon on Arrakis. It deflected scientific inquiry. It was so useful right from the outset that no one bothered to probe its mysteries. Leet turned to look at him. I thought that was why you were assigned here in the first place, to understand the spice. Yes, but we have more important work to do. I still report back to the Imperium often enough to convince them I'm working at my job, though not very successfully. Talking about the first time he'd been to this region, he drove toward a cluster of dirty buildings the color of sand and dust. The ground car jounced over a rough rock, but Leet ignored it and stared ahead at the village, squinting in the harsh light of the desert morning. The morning air held the fragility of fine crystal. "Something's wrong," he said, interrupting his father. Kynes continued talking for a few seconds and then brought the vehicle to a stop. "What's that?" "Something is wrong." Leet pointed ahead at the village. Kynes shaded his eyes against the glare. "I don't see anything." "Still, let us proceed with caution." In the center of the village, they encountered a festival of horrors. The surviving victims wandered about as if insane, shrieking and snarling like animals. The noise was horrific, as was the smell. They had ripped hair out of their heads in bloody clumps. Some used long fingernails to claw the eyes out of their faces, then held the scooped eyeballs in their palms. Blind, they staggered against the tan walls of dwellings, leaving wet crimson smears. "By Shai Hulud," Leet whispered under his breath, while his father let out a louder curse in common Imperial Galak. One man with torn eye sockets, like bloody extra mouths above his cheekbones, collided with a crawling woman. Both victims flew into a rage and ripped at each other's skin with bare hands, biting and spitting and screaming. There were muddy spots on the street, overturned containers of water. Many bodies lay sprawled on the ground like squashed insects, arms and legs stiffened at odd angles. Some buildings were locked and shuttered, barricaded against the crazed wretches outside who pounded on the walls, wailing wordlessly to get in. On an upper floor, Leet saw a woman's terrified face at the dust-streaked window glass. Others hid, somehow unaffected by the murderous insanity. "We must help these people, Father." Leet leaped out of the sealed ground car before his father had brought it to a complete stop. "Bring your weapons. We may need to defend ourselves." They carried old Maula pistols as well as knives. His father, though a scientist at heart, was also a good fighter, a skill he reserved for defending his vision for Arrakis. The legend was told of how he had slain several Harkonnen bravos who'd been attempting to kill three young freemen. Those rescued freemen were now his most loyal lieutenants, Stilgar, Turok, and Amun. But Pardot Kynes had never fought against anything like this. The maddened villagers noticed them and moaned. They began to move forward. "Don't kill them unless you must," Kynes said, amazed at how quickly his son had armed himself with a kris knife and Maula pistol. "Watch yourself." Leet ventured into the street. What struck him first was the terrible stink, as if the foul breath of a dying leper had been captured in a bottle and slowly released. Staring in disbelief, Pardit stepped farther from the ground car. He saw no laser gun burn marks in the village, no chip scars from projectile weapons, nothing that would have indicated an overt Harkonnen attack. Was it a disease? If so, it might be contagious. If a plague or some kind of communicable insanity was at work here, he could not let the Freeman take these bodies for the death stills. Leet moved forward. Freeman would attribute this to demons. Two of the bloody-faced victims let out demonic shrieks and rushed toward them, their fingers outstretched like eagle claws, their mouths open like bottomless pits. Leet pointed the Maula pistol, uttered a quick prayer, then fired twice. The perfect shots hit each of the attackers in the chest, and they fell dead. Leet bowed. "Forgive me, Shai-Hulud." Pardit watched him. "I have tried to teach my son many things, but at least he has learned compassion. All other information can be learned from film books, but not compassion. This was born into him." The young man bent over the two bodies, studied them closely, pushing back his superstitious fear. "I do not think it's a disease." He looked back at Pardit. "I've assisted the siege healers, as you know, and..." His voice trailed off.
"What then?"
"I believe they've been poisoned." One by one, the tortured villagers wandering the dusty streets fell onto their backs in screaming convulsions, until only three remained alive. Leet moved quickly with the kris knife and dispatched the last victims painlessly and efficiently. No tribe or village would ever accept them again, no matter how much they recovered, for fear that they had been corrupted by demons. Even their water would be considered tainted. Leet found it odd how easily he had taken command in front of his father. He gestured toward two of the sealed buildings. "Convince the people inside those barred dwellings that we mean them no harm. We must discover what happened here." His voice became low and icy. "And we must learn who is to blame." Pardit Kynes moved to the dusty building. Fingernail scratches and bloody handprints marked the mud brick walls and pitted metal doors where crazed victims had tried to pound their way in. He swallowed hard and prepared to make his case, to convince the terrified survivors that their ordeal was over. He turned back to his son. "Where will you be, Leet?" The young man looked at an overturned water container. He knew of only one way the poison could affect so many people at once. "Checking the water supply." His face etched in concern, Pardit nodded. Leet studied the terrain around the village, saw a faint trail leading up the side of the overhanging mesa. Moving with the speed of a sun-warmed lizard, he scurried up the mountain path and reached the cistern. The evidence of its location had been cleverly disguised, though the villagers had made many errors. Even a clumsy Harkonnen patrol could have discovered the illegal reservoir. He studied the area quickly, noting patterns in the sand. Smelling a harsh, alkaloid bitterness near the upper opening of the cistern, he tried to place the odor. He'd experienced it rarely, and only during great siege celebrations. The water of life. The Freeman consumed such a substance only after a Sayadina had converted the exhalation of a drowned worm, using her own body chemistry as a catalyst to create a tolerable drug that sent the siege into an ecstatic frenzy. Unconverted, the substance was a ferocious toxin. The villagers in Bilar camp had drunk pure water of life before it was transformed. Someone had done this intentionally, poisoning them. Then he saw the marks of ornithopter pads in the soft soil atop the plateau. It had to be a Harkonnenthopter, one of the regular patrols. A practical joke? Frowning grimly, Leet descended to the devastated village, where his father had succeeded in bringing out the survivors who had barricaded themselves within their dwellings. Through luck, these people had not drunk the poisoned water. Now they fell to their knees in the streets, surrounded by the awful carnage. Their keening cries of grief drifted like the thin wails of ghosts along a sheer cliffside. Harkonnens did this. Hardit Kynes moved about doing what he could to comfort them. But from the quizzical expressions on the villagers' faces, Leet knew his father was probably saying the wrong things, expressing his sympathy in abstract concepts that they had no ability to understand. Leet moved down the slope, and already plans were forming in his mind. As soon as they returned to the siege, he would meet with Stilgar and his commando squad, and they would plan their retaliation against the Harkonnens. An empire built on power cannot attract the affections and loyalty that men bestow willingly on a regime of ideas and beauty. Adorn your grand empire with beauty, with culture. From a speech by Crown Prince Raphael Corino, L'Institut de Caetane Archives. The years had been unkind to Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. In a rage, he wiped his wormhead walking stick across the counter in his therapy room. Jars of ointments, salves, pills, and hypo-injectors crashed to the tile floor. Nothing works! Each day he felt worse, looked more revolting. In the mirror, he saw a puffy, red-faced caricature of his Adonis self, hardly recognizable as the person he had once been. I look like a tumor, not a man. With darting movements, Peter de Vries stepped into the room, ready to offer assistance. The Baron struck at him with the heavy cane, but the Mentat sidestepped the blow with the grace of a cobra. Get out of my sight, Peter! The Baron reeled, trying to catch his balance. Or this time I really will think of a way to kill you. Whatever my Baron wishes, de Vries said in a too silken voice. He bowed and retreated to the door. The Baron held affection for few people, but he appreciated the devious workings of the twisted Mentat's mind. His convoluted plans, his long-term thinking, regardless of his obnoxious familiarity and lack of respect. Wait, Peter. I need your Mentat brain. He lumbered forward, leaning on the walking stick. It's the same old question. Find out why my body is degenerating, or I will dispatch you to the deepest slave pit. The whip-thin man waited for the Baron to catch up with him. I shall do my best, Baron. I know full well what happened to all of your doctors. Incompetence, he growled. None of them knew anything. Formerly healthy and full of tremendous energy, the Baron suffered from a debilitating disease whose manifestations disgusted and frightened him. He had gained an enormous amount of weight. Exercise did not help, nor did medical scans or even exploratory surgeries. For years he had tried every healing procedure and bizarre experimental treatment, all to no avail. For their failures, a score of house doctors had received torturous deaths at the hands of Peter de Vries, often through imaginative application of their own instruments. As a result, no high-level medical practitioners remained on Gedi Prime. or at least none were visible. Those who had not been executed had gone into hiding or fled to other worlds. More annoyingly, servants had begun disappearing too, and not always because the Baron had ordered them killed. They had fled outside the castle keep into Harko City, vanishing into the ranks of uncounted and unheeded laborers. As he ventured out into the streets, accompanied by his guard captain, Kriubi, the Baron found himself constantly looking for people who even resembled the servants who had abandoned him. Wherever he went, he left a trail of bodies. The killings brought him little pleasure, though. He would rather have had an answer. De Vries accompanied the Baron as he hobbled into the corridor. His walking stick clicked along the floor. Soon, the big man thought, he would have to wear a suspensor mechanism to remove the burden from his aching joints. A team of workmen froze as the two approached. The Baron noted that they were repairing wall damage he had caused in a rage the day before. Each of them bowed as the Baron clicked past and breathed audible sighs of relief when they saw him disappear around a corner. When he and De Vries reached a cerulean-curtained drawing room, the Baron lowered himself onto a black, slig-skin settee.
"Sit beside me, Peter."
The Mentat's inky eyes darted around, like those of a trapped animal. But the Baron snorted with impatience.
"I probably won't kill you today, provided you give me good advice."
The Mentat maintained his casual demeanor, revealing none of his private thoughts.
"Advising you is the sole purpose of my existence, my Baron."
He remained aloof, even arrogant, because he knew it would be far too costly for House Harkonnen to replace him, though the Bene Tlaloc could always grow another Mentat from the same genetic stock. In fact, they probably already had replacements, just waiting. The Baron drummed his fingers on the arm of the settee.
"True enough, but you don't always give the advice I need."
Looking closely at De Vries, he added,
"You are a very ugly man, Peter. Even with my disease, I'm still prettier than you."
The Mentat's salamander tongue darted over lips stained crimson by sappho juice.
"But, my sweet Baron, you always liked to look at me."
The Baron's face hardened, and he leaned close to the tall, thin man.
"Enough relying on amateurs. I want you to obtain a souk doctor for me."
Surprised, De Vries drew a quick breath.
"But you have insisted that we maintain complete secrecy about the nature of your condition. A souk must report all activities to his inner circle and send them the bulk of his fee."
Vladimir Harkonnen had led members of the Landsrad to believe he'd grown corpulent through his own excesses, which was an acceptable reason to him, one that did not imply weakness. And, given the Baron's tastes, it was a lie easy to believe. He did not wish to become a pitiable laughingstock among the other nobles. A great Baron should not suffer from a simple, embarrassing disease.
"Just find a way to do it. Don't go through regular channels. If a souk can cure me, then I'll have nothing to hide."
Several days later, Peter De Vries learned that a talented, if somewhat narcissistic, souk doctor had been stationed on Richiz, an ally of the Harkonnens. The wheels in the Mentat's mind began to turn. In the past, House Richiz had aided Harkonnen-inspired plots, including the assassination of Duke Paulus Atreides in the Bull Ring. But the allies often disagreed on priorities. For this most sensitive of all matters, De Vries invited the Richizian premier, Ein Kalimar, to visit the Baron's keep on Gedi Prime to discuss a mutually profitable enterprise. An older, meticulously dressed man who retained his youthful athleticism, Kalimar had dark skin and a wide nose with wire-rimmed eyeglasses perched on it.
He arrived at the Harco City spaceport wearing a white suit with gold lapels. Four guards in blue Harkonnen livery escorted him into the Baron's private quarters. Once he stepped inside the private chambers, the Premier's nose twitched at an odor, which did not escape his host's bemused notice. The nude body of a young boy hung in a closet only 2 meters away. The Baron had intentionally left the door open a crack. The corpse's putrid odor mixed and interlocked with older ones that had permeated the rooms to such a degree that even strong perfumes did not conceal them.
"Please sit."
The Baron pointed to a couch where faint bloodstains could still be seen. He had prepared this entire meeting with subliminal threats and unpleasantness, just to set the Richesian leader on edge. Kalimar hesitated, a moment that delighted the Baron, then accepted the seat, but declined an offer of Kirana brandy, though his host took a snifter for himself. The Baron slumped into a bobbing suspensor chair. Behind him stood his fidgety personal mentat, who stated why House Harkonnen had requested the meeting. Surprised, Kalimar shook his head. "You wish to rent my souk, doctor?" His nose continued to twitch, and his gaze searched the room for a source of the odor, settling on the closet door. He adjusted his golden spectacles. "I'm sorry, but I am unable to comply. A personal souk physician is a responsibility and an obligation, not to mention an enormous expense." The Baron pouted. "I have tried other doctors, and I would prefer to keep this matter private. I cannot simply advertise for one of the arrogant professionals. Your souk doctor, though, would be bound by his oath of confidentiality, and no one needs to know he left your service for a brief period." He heard the whining tone in his own voice. "Come, come, where is your compassion?" Kalimar looked away from the dark closet. "Compassion? An interesting comment from you, Baron. Your house hasn't bothered to help us with our problem, despite our entreaties over the last 5 years." The Baron leaned forward. His worm-head walking stick lay across his lap, its tip filled with serpent venom darts pointed toward the white-suited man. Tempting. So tempting. "Perhaps we could come to an understanding." He looked questioningly at his mentat for an explanation. De Vries said, "In a word, he means money, my Baron. The Richesian economy is floundering. As our ambassador has explained repeatedly to your emissaries," Kalimar added, "since my house lost control of the spice operations on Arrakis, you replaced us, don't forget. We have attempted to rebuild our economic foundation." The Premier held his chin high, pretending that he still had some pride left. "Initially, the downfall of Ix was a boon to us, removing competition. However, our finances remain somewhat strained." The Baron's spider-black eyes flashed, relishing Kalimar's embarrassment. "House Richies, manufacturers of exotic weaponry and complex machines, experts in miniaturization and Richesian mirrors, had made initial market share gains against rival Ixian companies during the upheavals on Ix. 5 years ago, the Tleilaxu began shipping Ixian products again," De Vries said with cold logic. "You are already losing whatever gains you made in the past 10 years. Sales of Richesian products have fallen off severely with the renewed availability of Ixian technology." Kalimar kept his voice steady. "So you see, we must have resources to enhance our efforts and invest in new facilities. Richies, Tleilax, Ix, we try not to interfere in squabbles between other houses." The Baron sighed. "I wish there could just be peace throughout the Landsraad." Anger seeped into the Premier's features.
This is more than a squabble, Baron. This is about survival. Many of my agents are missing on Ix and presumed dead. It disgusts me even to consider what the Tleilaxu may use their body parts for. He adjusted his spectacles. Perspiration glistened on his forehead. Besides, the Beni Tleilax are not a house of any sort. The Landsrad would never accept them. A mere technicality.
We arrive at an impasse, then, Kalimar announced, making as if to rise. He looked once more at the ominous closet door.
I did not believe you'd be willing to meet our stiff price, regardless of how excellent our Sook doctor is.
Wait, wait.
The Baron held up a hand. Trade agreements and military pacts are one thing. Friendship is another. You and your house have been our loyal ally in the past. Perhaps I didn't fully understand the scope of your problem before.
Kalimar tilted his head back, gazed down the bridge of his nose at the Baron.
The scope of our problem consists of many zeros and no decimal points. Set in folds of fat, his black eyes took on a crafty gaze. If you send me your Sook doctor, Premier, we shall rethink the situation. I'm sure you will be most pleased to hear the financial details of our offer. Consider it a down payment.
Kalimar refused to move.
I would like to hear the offer now, please.
Seeing the stony expression on the Premier's face, the Baron nodded.
Peter, tell him our proposal.
De Vries quoted a high price for the rental of the souk, payable in melange. No matter how much this souk doctor cost, House Harkonnen could squeeze out the extra income by liquidating some of their hidden, illegal spice stockpiles, or by tightening production on Arrakis.
Kalimar pretended to consider the offer, but the Baron knew the man had no choice but to accept.
The souk will be sent to you immediately. This doctor, Wellington Yue, has been working on cyborg studies, developing a machine-human interface to restore lost limbs through artificial means, an alternative to having the Tleilaxu grow replacements in their axolotl tanks.
Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind, De Vries quoted, the primary commandment arising out of the Butlerian jihad.
Kalimar stiffened.
Our patent lawyers have gone over this in detail, and there is no violation whatsoever.
Well, I don't care what his specialty is, the Baron said impatiently. All Sook doctors have broad reservoirs of knowledge upon which they can draw. You understand that this must be kept in strict confidence?
That is not a matter of concern. The Sook inner circle has held embarrassing medical information on every family in the Landsrad for generations. You need not worry.
I am more worried that your people will talk. Do I have your promise that you will not divulge any details of our bargain? It could prove just as embarrassing to you.
The Baron's dark eyes seemed to sink deeper into his puffy face.
A stiff nod from the Premier.
I am pleased to be of assistance, Baron. I have had the rare privilege of closely observing this Dr. Yue. Allow me to assure you that he is most impressive indeed.
Military victories are meaningless unless they reflect the wishes of the populace. An emperor exists only to clarify those wishes. He executes the popular will, or his time is short. Principium, Imperial Leadership Academy. Beneath a black security hood, the Emperor sat in his elaborate suspensor chair as he received information from the Redulian report crystal. After delivering the encrypted summary, Hasimir Fenring stood beside him while words streamed through Shaddam's mind. The Emperor did not like the news. At the conclusion of the progress summary, Fenring cleared his throat.
Hydar Fen Ajitika conceals much from us, sire. If he were not vitally important to Project Amal, I would terminate him. The Emperor swung the security hood from his head, removed the glittering crystal from its receptacle. Adjusting his eyes to the bright morning sunshine that passed through a skylight in his private tower quarters, he peered at Fenring. The other man lounged at the Emperor's desk of golden chusuk wood inlaid with milky sue stones, as if he owned it. "I see," Shaddam mused. "The little gnome isn't pleased to receive two more legions of Sardaukar. Commander Garon will put pressure on him to perform, and he feels the vice tightening around him." Fenring got up to pace in front of a window that overlooked a profusion of orange and lavender blossoms in a rooftop garden. He picked at something lodged beneath one of his fingernails and flicked it away. "Don't we all, Shaddam noticed that the Count's gaze had strayed to the holophotos of his three young daughters that Anirul had mounted on the wall, annoying reminders that he still had no male heir. Irulan was 4 years old, Chalice a year and a half, and baby Wensishia barely 2 months. Pointedly, he switched off the images and turned to his friend. "You're my eyes in the desert, Hasimir. It disturbs me that the Tleilaxu have been smuggling infant sandworms from Arrakis. I thought it couldn't be done." Fenring shrugged. "What could it possibly matter if they took a small worm or two? The creatures die soon after they leave the desert, despite every effort to care for them. Perhaps the ecosystem should not be disturbed." The Emperor's scarlet and gold tunic trailed over the edge of the suspensor chair onto the floor. He nibbled on a morsel of crimson fruit from a bowl beside him. "In his last report, our desert planetologist claims that reductions in particular species could have devastating consequences on food chains. He says there are prices to be paid by future generations for the mistakes of today." Fenring made a dismissive gesture. "You shouldn't bother yourself with his reports. If you brought me back from exile, sire, I could remove such worries from your mind. I'd do your thinking for you, Your assignment as Imperial Observer is hardly exile. You are a count, and you are my spice minister." Distracted, Shaddam thought about ordering something to drink, perhaps with music, exotic dancers, even a military parade outside. He had only to command it. But such things did not interest him at the moment. "Do you desire an additional title, Hasimir?" Averting his overlarge eyes, Fenring said, "Oh, that would only call more attention to me. Already it is difficult to conceal from the guild how often I journey to Shuta. Besides, trivial titles mean nothing to me." The Emperor tossed the pit of his fruit into the bowl, frowning. Next time he would order the preparers to cut out the seeds before serving them. "Is Padishah Emperor a trivial title?" At the sound of three beeps, the men looked up at the ceiling, from which a clearplaz tube spiraled down to a receptacle on the Emperor's chusuk wood desk. An urgent message cylinder streaked through the tube and thunked into place. Fenring retrieved the cylinder, cut off a courier seal, and removed two sheets of rolled Instroy paper, which he passed to the Emperor, restraining himself from examining them first. Shaddam unrolled them, scanned the pages with an expression of growing distress. Fenring asked in his impatient manner. "Another formal letter of complaint from Archduke Kaz, and a declaration of Canley against House Mauritani on Grumman. Most serious indeed." He wiped red juice from his fingertips onto his scarlet robe, then read further. His face flushed. "Wait a minute. Duke Leto Atreides has already offered his services to the Landsrat as a mediator, but the Akazis are taking the matter into their own hands." "Interesting," the Count said. Angrily, Shaddam thrust the letter into Fenring's hands.
Duke Leto found out before I did. How is this possible? I'm the Emperor.
Sire, the flare-up is not surprising, considering the disgraceful behavior at my formal banquet. Seeing the blank look, he continued. The Grumman ambassador assassinating his rival right at the dinner table? You remember my report? It came to you months ago,
As Shaddam struggled to put the pieces together in his mind, he waved dismissively at a black plaz shelf beside his desk. Maybe it's over there. I haven't read them all.
Fenring's dark eyes flashed with annoyance. You have time to read esoteric reports from a planetologist, but not from me. You would have been prepared for this feud if you'd paid attention to my communique. I warned you the Grummans are dangerous and bear watching.
I see. Just tell me what the report says, Hasimir. I'm a busy man.
Fenring recounted how he'd had to release the arrogant Lupino Ord, owing to diplomatic immunity. With a sigh, the Emperor summoned attendants and called an emergency meeting of his advisers. In the conference room adjoining Shaddam's imperial office, a team of Mentat legal advisers, Lansrad spokesmen, and guild observers reviewed the technicalities of Canley, the careful ballet of warfare designed to harm only actual combatants, with minimal collateral damage to civilians. The Great Convention prohibited the use of atomic and biological weapons and required that disputing houses fight a controlled feud through accepted direct and indirect methods. For millennia, the rigid rules had formed the framework of the Imperium. Advisors recounted the background of the current conflict, how Ikaz had accused Mauritani of biological sabotage in their delicate fog tree forests, how the Grumman ambassador had murdered his Ikazi counterpart at Fenring's banquet, how Archduke Ikaz had formally declared Canley against Viscount Mauritani. Another item of note, said the Imperial Trade Chief, waving one knobby finger like a rapier in the air. I have learned that an entire shipment of commemorative coins, minted, if you recall, sire, to celebrate your 10th anniversary on the Golden Lion throne, has been stolen in an audacious raid on a commercial frigate, by self-styled space pirates, if reports are to be believed.
Shaddam glowered, impatient. How is a petty theft relevant to the situation here?
That shipment was bound for Ikaz, sire.
Fenring perked up.
Was anything else stolen? War materiel, weapons of any kind? The trade chief checked his notes.
No. The so-called raiders commandeered only the imperial commemorative coins, leaving other valuables behind.
He lowered his voice and mumbled, as if to himself. However, since we used inferior materials in minting those coins, the financial losses are not significant.
I recommend that we dispatch imperial observers to Ikaz and to Grumman, Court Chamberlain Redondo said, in order to enforce the forms. House Mauritani has been known to stretch their interpretation of formal rules.
Redondo was a skeletally gaunt man with yellowish skin and a slippery way of accomplishing tasks while allowing Shaddam to take the credit. He had fared well in his position as Chamberlain. Before Redondo's suggestion could be discussed, though, another message cylinder thumped into the receptacle beside the Emperor's chair. After scanning the message, Shaddam slammed it onto the conference table.
Viscount Hundro Mauritani has responded to the diplomatic insult by carpet-bombing the Ikazi Palace and its surrounding peninsula. The Mahogany Throne is physically destroyed. 100,000 non-combatants dead, and several forests are on fire. Archduke Ikaz barely escaped with his three daughters.
He squinted down at the curling Instroy paper again, then looked quickly at Fenring, but refused to ask for advice.
He disregarded the strictures of Canley, the trade chief said in shock. How can they do that?
The sallow skin on Chamberlain Redondo's towering forehead wrinkled with concern.
Viscount Moritani does not have the honor of his grandfather, who was a friend of the hunter. What is to be done with wild dogs such as these?
Grumman has always hated being part of the Imperium, sire, Fenring pointed out. They constantly seek opportunities to spit in our faces.
The discussion around the table took on a more frenetic tone. As Shaddam listened to the talk, trying to look regal, he reflected on how different it was to be emperor from how he'd imagined. Reality was exceedingly complicated, with too many competing forces. He recalled playing war games with young Hasimir, and realized how much he missed his boyhood friend's companionship and advice. But an emperor could not reverse important decisions lightly. Fenring would remain in his Arrakis assignment, and in the allied duty of overseeing the artificial spice program. It was better if spies believed the stories of friction between them, though perhaps Shaddam could schedule more frequent visits with his childhood companion.
The forms must be obeyed, sire, Redondo said. Law and tradition bind the Imperium. We cannot allow one noble house to ignore the strictures as they choose. Clearly Moritani sees you as weak and unwilling to intervene in this squabble. He's taunting you.
The Imperium will not slip through my fingers, Shaddam vowed.
He decided to set an example.
Let it be known throughout the Imperium that a legion of Sardaukar troops is to be stationed on Grumman for a period of 2 years. We'll put a leash on this, Viscount.
He turned to the Spacing Guild observer at the far end of the table. Furthermore, I want the Guild to levy a heavy tariff on all goods delivered to and from Grumman. Such income to be used for reparations to Akaz.
The Guild representative sat in silence for a long, cold moment, as if pondering the decision, which was in reality only a request. The Guild was beyond the control of the Padishah Emperor. Finally, he nodded.
It will be done.
One of the court mentats sat rigidly in his chair.
They will appeal, sire.
Shaddam sniffed.
If Moritani has a case, let him make it.
Fenring tapped his fingers on the table, considering consequences. Shaddam had already dispatched 2 legions of Sardaukar to oversee the Tleilaxu on Ix, and now he was sending more to Grumman. In other trouble spots around the Imperium, he had increased the visible presence of his crack military troops, hoping to smother any thoughts of rebellion. He had increased the ranks of the Bursegs throughout the military, adding more mid-level commanders to be dispatched with troops as needed. Even so, small and annoying instances of sabotage or defacement continued to occur in random places, such as the theft of commemorative coins bound for Akaz, the balloon effigy of Shaddam floating over the Harmonthep Stadium, the insulting words painted on the cliffs of Monument Canyon. As a result, the loyal Sardaukar were spread too thinly, and because of the costly Project Amal, the Imperial Treasury had insufficient funds to train and supply new troops.